They're very quiet, kind of, you know, hesitant. And then finally, one of the participants said, you know, your idea is great, but I can't even find a pair of pants that I can wear to work. And then another participant said, you know, she's right. I can't find a swimsuit for my daughter. And it was just this like domino effect of people then finally saying all of the apparel challenges that they had or disabled. And I'm sitting in the back of the room appalled at how archaic our discipline and our industry is. I'm like, some of these problems that they're talking about can be fixed with a buttonhole. Like, without having to, if I want to access an external medical device, I don't have to take the clothes off my child. I can put a buttonhole somewhere and access it. And like, we're not talking rocket science here.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we welcome Dr. Carrie McBee Black, an assistant professor and the Helen Allen Faculty Fellow in the Textile and Apparel Management Department at the University of Missouri, Columbia. Carrie's groundbreaking research focuses on the critical intersection of disability and apparel. She has made significant contributions to this area, including publishing 11 peer-reviewed journal articles and delivering 41 presentations at international conferences. In the classroom, Carrie passionately advocates for user-centered and human-centered design. She inspires her students to develop products with their end users in mind, fostering innovation and inclusivity. Her commitment to education is evident in her dedication to professional development. She has earned multiple teaching awards, completed workshops, and most recently achieved certification in effective online teaching practices through the Association of College and University Educators. Additionally, she earned the prestigious CLO 3D Virtual Fashion Educator Accreditation in 2023 by integrating cutting-edge technology into her curriculum to enhance student learning. Beyond the classroom, Carrie serves as Chief Research Officer with Gamut Management, where she leverages her expertise to consult on the needs and wants of people with disabilities, also known as PWDs, in the adaptive apparel market. Through her research and collaboration with brands entering the space, she ensures that the voices of PWDs, people with disabilities, are heard and their unique requirements are incorporated into products and the supply chain processes. Carrie's mission is to drive inclusion throughout the apparel industry, improving products and practices to serve people with disabilities better. Her specialties in social science research, qualitative methods, teaching with technology, and coalition building make her a leader in both academia and industry. We are excited to learn from her insights and explore how her work shapes the future of inclusive apparel design. Carrie, welcome to the Innovation Insights Podcast.
Thanks, Yolanda. I'm so glad to be here with you.
Hey, you know, you have been on my list to be on the podcast for a while, and so I'm so glad that we're able to do this. I think we met originally, maybe it was at Target, when Target was doing their...
That's right. I think it was. That was seemed forever ago.
So Target Corporation used to do some kind of workshops and seminars for academic faculty in fashion. And so Carrie had attended one of those and I was there. And so I remember meeting her there. I was just very impressed with her. I was like, I want to be like Carrie someday when I grow up.
Yep. I felt like on the other side, I want to be like you want to.
Well, I haven't grown up yet, so. Oh, well, tell us about your journey. How did you get involved with textile and apparel?
So that is an interesting journey. My journey is similar to yours, actually, because I was in 4-H when I was a kid. And, you know, when you grew up in a rural area, 4-H was kind of the thing to do. And back then it was, you know, girls cooked, baked, sewed, did crafting, right? So the first time I ever sewed anything was in 4-H, and I had grown up watching my mom sew. Like, she had a sewing machine out, and, you know, right out in the middle of our home, and sewed for my sister and I and herself. And I did really enjoy the sewing part when I was in 4-H. Like, I thought, oh, I wanted, you know, I wanted store-bought stuff. I wanted to look trendy, and I didn't think you could do that with sewing stuff on your own. But that love of kind of thinking about style and thinking about fabrics and thinking about all that just kind of continued into my teenage years. And I loved shopping with my friends. And when I got into high school, they had home economics, right? So kind of a required class you had to take. Back then, I took a home economics one semester, and then you did driver's ed like the next semester, right? Back in the day. And I began to really think about fashion in a broader sense, but still didn't have a concept as to really what it was. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I convinced our home economics teacher, I'm like, I need more fashion classes. And so she was like, okay, I'll teach an advanced class if you can get 6 more people to take the class. So I'm like running around my high school, like begging all my friends, just take this class with me. And then I went into my undergraduate as a fashion designer and just completely fell in love with the sewing process at that point. Like, I really embraced that component of being a designer and went into the industry and continued my work into grad school and, you know, fell in love with production part of it too. Like, learning about the actual industry production and manufacturing part was absolutely fascinating to me. But I had no idea about the global impact of fashion and apparel when I was a teenager. I just thought shopping was fun, right? So that's kind of what got me into that space.
Well, thank goodness. Thank goodness. Yay.
What? Thank God for 4-H.
Thank goodness for 4-H and friend shopping, you know? I still think shopping is fun. What?
Yes. Yeah. Agreed.
So you were in industry and, you know, sounds like you're working on the production manufacturing side quite a bit. What made you decide to go to graduate school?
That is also an interesting story. So my primary interest as a design student was children's wear. So I kind of fell in love with children's wear. My senior design collection was 28 individual garments, which was the largest collection in the history of our department at the time. I was slightly, I don't know, motivated to do that much. I just couldn't stop myself. And when I went into the industry, I worked in children's wear and had the chance. This was right before NAFTA hit. And so all of our production, the Carter company that I worked for, was down in Atlanta, South Atlanta. And we still had all of our production was domestic. It was all in Southern Georgia. So I had the absolute wonderful experience to go down to our manufacturing facilities and approve strike-offs and lad dips and watch sample making. And I got so enthralled with just that process of the industry that I didn't even realize was a thing. But I had always in the back of my mind, I just love learning. I love being in the classroom. I love engaging in thought-provoking conversations and challenging myself. And so nobody had ever said to me, oh, Carrie, you would be good, you know, as a graduate student. Nobody ever told me that. But it was always something in the back of my mind. And I had no idea what it was. I'm a first-generation college student. My parents had never gone to college. They didn't know what graduate school was. And I left the industry because I wanted to go to graduate school. And I had people that I worked with at Carter that I considered mentors that told me, oh, it's going to be a waste of time, right? Because you don't have to have that degree to be successful. And I'm like, well, your definition of success, my definition of success are two different things. So it was just purely my dad, God bless him, told me when I was thinking about it, he said, you know, you're young. If this is what you want to do, do it. You know, you don't have to know all the details about it. You'll figure it out as you go. And I did. I made mistakes. That master's program was not, you know, not the best starting off point, having been a first generation student. But yeah, it was the best path I could have taken, I think.
Well, and what a great message too, that, you know, you might not, that your father had, that you might not know. And I think I know many of our students think that, yes, when they're graduating, that they need to have everything mapped out. I mean, I used to think that. I thought I needed to achieve everything by the time I was 25, because I don't know what that what I thought was going to happen at 22. So what a great message from your father to, you know, do it. And yeah, you don't know what's going to happen, but that's okay.
No. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you don't know what you don't know, which is one of the things you figure out when you go to grad school. There's a lot you don't know. But yeah, thank God my dad and my mom were just, you know, even though it was something that they just didn't know, they weren't afraid of it. They weren't scared. And they were like encouraged, like, you know, get as much education as you can, kid, because, you know, that is the best investment you can make in yourself.
That's fabulous. That is fabulous. So then what made you decide to get a doctorate?
So I took a break after my master's program. I don't know if I probably have never told you this because I've never had enough lengthy enough conversation with you to tell you, but despite being so anxious and energetic to start my master's program, I had a little bit of that. I had one person on my master's committee that I didn't get the chance to choose. So this was in the, you know, mid-90s, right? So graduate education was slightly different back then than it is now, thank God. And it was a very tumultuous relationship. And so I found a mentor in my department who, she's no longer with us, but she, if it weren't for her, I wouldn't be where I am today, because she and I would literally meet in the basement of our building, like back in a corner, once a week. And I would just vent to her about my challenges. And she would give me advice about, you know, how to navigate graduate studies and being a graduate student and the hierarchy and the politics and all the things that come along with it. And she was like, you know, don't let it stop you. Like, you are intelligent, you are smart, you have the capability, you just got this barrier in front of you. But by the time I finished my master's, I was exhausted, Yolanda, like just from that challenge of trying to prove myself every day, not only to somebody else, but to myself, that I could kind of do it. So I'm like, I'm going to go back to the industry, take a break, which I thought would be, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. It ended up being 20 years. I came back when I was 45 to finish my PhD. So if I can do it at 45, and I was teaching full time, I had a son that was in elementary school, a husband, aging parents that we had moved in with us. If I can do it at 45, anybody can do it. But even though it's this really traversed, winding path, it brought me exactly where I need to be. Because I think about the research I'm doing now, I wouldn't have been that person if I'd have finished my PhD immediately. So there was something at play that made me take that diversion and brought me back, I think, because this is where I'm meant to be.
I love that, because so many times we have twists and turns in this journey and we're like, why? Why? It's not fair. Why? You know, but yeah, it all works out in the end. It really does. It really does.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember meeting you. Yeah, I think it was right when you first had started. And then we were at an ITAA. We were traveling there, and you and your husband and your son were there traveling. I think we were commuting from the airport to the hotel and tried to navigate that in a new city. Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, the discipline is lucky to have you.
Yep.
And especially the area that you're focusing on and that you are bringing to light and you are trailblazing in.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that.
Thank you. Thank you. So what brought you to focus on the intersection of disability and apparel?
Surprise, surprise. That's another interesting story. So I was not in my PhD program at the time, but I was teaching full-time for the department at the University of Missouri. And I got a phone call one day randomly from a colleague that I didn't know out of the School of Health Professions. And she said, you know, your former admin assistant who now works at our department said I should reach out to you and talk to you about my research interests. Would you like to have lunch? And I'm like, sure. Because my other story that my dad gave me advice on was, you never know what's behind those doors. So anytime an opportunity presents itself, say yes, because you don't know until you open that door. So I was like, sure, let's have lunch. Worst thing that comes out of it is that I got a lunch and there was nothing else, right? So when I met her, she had been on a curriculum committee for our undergraduate curriculum and saw our department and didn't know that we existed as a department, which often happens with most of other peer institutions. And she was an anthropologist by trade, but was working in the School of Health Professions, looking at how the person interacts with healthcare, how the human is a part of that healthcare system. So she was thinking about how we show up in a healthcare setting with what we wear, because we self-express through what we wear. But then as soon as we're in engaged in that healthcare system, we're taken out of that personality and put in something else. So we started brainstorming, really kind of connected, like as you know, a good peer-to-peer connection, and decided we were going to do this research on RFID, radio frequency identification device tracking for people who have dementia and people along the autism spectrum, because they have a tendency to wander, and there's a higher rate of drowning among people with autism. They're, for whatever reason, attracted to bodies of water, so their rates of drowning are higher because they'll fall into the water or whatever. So we were thinking, oh, this would be a great solution to a problem that parents and caregivers have. So like good qualitative researchers, we, you know, tried to make our study broad enough that we could kind of collect whatever kind of cream rose to the top, scheduled a focus group, held the focus group, had like 20 people at a focus group, which was very large, but it was people with disabilities and their caregivers. And we're pitching them, you know, our idea basically, and asking them about RFID technology. And they're very quiet, kind of, you know, hesitant. And then finally, one of the participants said, you know, your idea is great, but I can't even find a pair of pants that I can wear to work. And then another participant said, you know, she's right, I can't find a swimsuit for my daughter. And it was just this like domino effect of people then finally saying all of the apparel challenges that they had or disabled. And I'm sitting in the back of the room appalled at how archaic our discipline and our industry is. I'm like, some of these problems that they're talking about can be fixed with a buttonhole. Like, without having to, if I want to access an external medical device, I don't have to take the clothes off of my child. I can put a buttonhole somewhere and access it. And I'm like, we're not talking rocket science here. So we convened after that meeting and said, you know, we got to switch our objectives and our purpose with this research. We started doing more interviews and started doing more focus groups, and people were really just unbelievably excited about sharing what they had challenges with, because nobody was doing that and caring about what they wanted to do. So that was about 2013 when we started doing that, but could not get our research published to save our lives. Got rejected and rejected and rejected, because they would say, people with disabilities don't care about clothes. They don't care about fashion. They just need to, you know, just need to worry about, you know, getting out of the house. They don't care what they look like. And so it was a constant battle of trying to educate the people that you were trying to get your research in front of, because the topic was just so undiscovered. Like, nobody was really talking about it at that stage. It was very frustrating, but that is the kind of the odd way that I got into it. I don't identify as being disabled at the time. I didn't have anybody in my family that identified. My son's since been diagnosed with ADHD, and I have an aging parent. So, you know, disability in terms of just aging related disability. But at that time, I didn't have an identity that was around disability, which is unusual for somebody getting into that research, because usually it has to be a personal connection that drives you to it. But I'm telling you what, it's a passion project now, because after that, I'm like, this is the rest of my career.
Well, and that just says so much about who you are, that it didn't have to be personal for you to take it on. You know, I mean, that just says volumes about who you are, and just even raises my level of respect even higher. Oh, my goodness. And so if I'm tracking this conversation correctly, you hadn't even started graduate school yet. Your doctorate.
No.
I love it.
Not
okay.
Not a doctor. I was just had my master's degree And that was kind of what prompted me onto that PhD track, is because my colleague, Allison, that I was doing this research with, we're doing all this work and trying to publish and writing grants. And she was like, you know, there's going to be a lot that you can't do because you don't have those three letters after your name. She goes, you're doing all the work of somebody with a PhD. You just don't have. And I was like, but it's been so many years since I was in a graduate program and, you know, could I do it? And then, you know, my department chair now, but was a colleague, Dr. Jung Ha Berkshire, had been encouraging me. And I was like, yeah, but I don't think. And I didn't think I was a researcher, Yolanda, believe it or not. Like, I never had the confidence to believe that I could do research because I had that bad experience as a master's student that kind of impacted my confidence all those years later. But then after doing the research and feeling the passion and realizing how needed the information was to try to drive change. Like the fact that there's more pet clothes than there are clothes for people with disabilities is appalling. And so I have a social justice background anyway, like I've been that kind of a person in the past. So I'm like, this is a natural progression for me. I'm like, damn it, I'm gonna make people pay attention to this issue, right? Like people are gonna pay attention that this is something we need to be dealing with. So I finally was like, I'm gonna get this PhD because why wouldn't I? If I'm doing all the work, might as well get the credit for it, right? Like might as well have that credit for it.
Well, I'm just so thankful that you have and that you've had the passion and the vision of what needs to be done and just the this needs to be changed. This needs to change.
That's right. I've always been that kind of a black and white person. I'm like, I know the world is made up of a lot of gray area, but for some issues, it's black or white. Like there is no gray area. You're either on the right side or the wrong side. And that's the end of this discussion.
I love it. Well,
I'm be on the right side.
I'm so glad that you are on that right side and that you're pulling people, pushing, screaming, and you've done such a great job of also integrating it with industry and your industry connection.
Right.
So would you talk about that? Because, you know, oftentimes in academics and also the world thinks like, you know, we're off in our ivory tower and we just do this research and then nothing happens with it. But you are really, you know, we're an applied research area for most parts, and you really are even taking it beyond just applying, but just getting in front of industry with it.
That's right. So when I started doing that research about 2013, it literally took almost, 2.5 years by the time you think about getting something through the publication process to get our first article even published. So it didn't get published until 2016 was the first article that we got published with Allison Cable and I. And it was at that, it was like the perfect storm, I tell people, because it was at that time that Tommy Hilfiger's Children's Adaptive line launched. It was when Target started doing their Cat and Jack line. It was when Zappos started doing their adaptive thing. So it was like people, there was Tommy Hilfiger, because of the brand, drew a lot of media attention. So there was lots of people talking about it. So me being me, I'm like, I'm going to just call all these people and talk to them about my research because we should be friends because we're all doing the same thing. So I literally stalked Mindy Shire that did the work with Tommy Hilfiger and Runway of Dreams. I found out who the person was at Zappos that was running the adaptive team, stalked them. In fact, Dana Zumbo, who spoke at ART, was a 2019 Las Vegas conference. So she tells the story too, because I called Zappos headquarters and I'm like, I need to speak to Dana Zumbo. And they're like, do you have her extension? I'm like, no. And they said, well, we don't just let, you know, we're not going to just give you her line, will take a message. And so I'm like, fine. So I left the message thinking I'd never hear from her. She called me the very next day. And we have stayed connected since then. Mindy and I have stayed connected. I have tried to reach out to every single person that I have found out about that's working in this space, because I can't do it all. There's no way. I don't have the capacity. I can't do all the different types of research. I'm not that brilliant. I don't have enough time. There's plenty of it to go around. So we need to have this kind of coalition of people. And I knew that the where the rubber met the road was if I wrote papers and talked about how this was needed, that's cool. But until it was in a store where people with disabilities could buy it, what's the point? So it was a no-brainer. Like, industry had to get engaged. And so I put myself out there. I'm like, you know, if they tell me no, they tell me no. I'll just move on down the road and go to the next person until I find somebody that says yes. So, and the really cool thing about this particular type of research is that the people that have gotten into it from the industry either have a personal relationship with disability or have either personally or, you know, adjacently had experience with it. And when we find somebody else that we know has that same passion for the issue, that's not just trying to take advantage of an underserved and underrepresented population, which we know happens a lot, we are like, we're siblings forever. Like, there is a deep connection that I have never felt in another networking coalition collaboration that I have ever done in my entire career, whether that's academic, industry, or social justice. It is this, the group of people that are around this topic are just some of the best humans I have ever met in my life.
Oh my gosh, so much to say. so many thoughts here. Thank you for doing this. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, we should probably have a live, you know, we do live panels for Innovation Insights. Oh. We should do a live panel. So I'll be bugging you again. And I know I've already bugged, you know, one of your colleagues in the UK to be on. I think we should do some live panels. And so let's talk about that. Another thought, you know, is a little bit off topic is just, you know, you mentioned how long it took to get your research out there. And, I've been around forever since the beginning of the discipline, I think. my former dissertation advisor would not, it was Joan Laughlin, who some people know in the discipline that was, you know, like, yeah, icon. You probably tell me a lot that you're still a neophyte because she used to call me a neophyte.
You're like, I'm going to be for the rest of my life.
I've been around a long time. Part of my thoughts are is that, you know, we need to figure out some ways, and maybe this is something that I can do with Innovation Insights, is to disseminate some case studies, some information faster, you know. That's not disruptive of, you know, the promotion and tenure process requires, you know, peer review scholarly, but can we get parts the research out there faster in a more usable way for both academia and industry? Because there's some really amazing things. So I will think about this, and I will also talk with my best friend, ChatGPT, and we'll...
I know, don't you?
We'll brainstorm.
I didn't know we have the same best friend.
It's really bad when your mind starts telling me, oh, that's a good idea. You know, and, you know, I'm like spitting in prompts at midnight. And it's like, okay, come on. You want to work on this some more? Let's get, I'm like, best friend who's a machine. I'm tired. And no, I don't want to work on this more right now. I just look like you.
Leave me alone, ChatGPT.
But seriously, I'm just thinking about that. But, you know, thank you for just making that bridge again between academia and industry and such an important topic. You know, and what's really fun to see is that now you have students, you know, we just recently had, you know, our main conference, International Textile Apparel Conference, and I think I was presiding or trying to preside over a session and
trying to.
Well, they tried. And, you know, one of your students, you know, is doing some incredible work, you know. So tell us a little bit about how are you preparing this next generation of scholars to, you know, be on the right side.
Exactly. Well, one of the first things I do is I try to include empathy into my classes, right? So I do a lot of conversations with my students about our classroom as a community. and it's a safe space and we can make mistakes and there's no judgment and we're going to come in here and we're going to try. But that's all I expect. Because if you try, you're going to learn. I mean, that's just, it's a human. So I try to establish that. But then at the same time, I introduce this topic. And I used to first do it like, you know, make them look at people with disabilities. And since then, I've evolved and become a little bit more flexible. And so now it's like just underrepresented consumer groups, right? Like, it's not just people with disabilities that are underrepresented. Let's look at all of the underrepresented groups that are out there. Aging, religion, race and ethnicity, and ability and inability, and all the things that go into gender, non-conforming gender, all the things that go into it. And so I had to let go of my control a little bit because I had this idea of what I wanted my students to, their outcome to be. And then I realized, you know, I have to let them show me how they interpret this. Like this, that's part of being a teacher, an educator, like giving up some of your control and seeing if they can take what you've given them and run with it. And I have been every single semester, I'm amazed. And I've integrated from my introductory class where they just kind of conceptualize ideas all the way to my capstone class. And I have students that are right now I'm teaching the capstone class and we were talking about they're going to do user-centered design in the capstone class where they have to engage with the user throughout the process. And I have a student that wants to work with women in construction because of workwear challenges, right? I have another one that wants to work with patients in Alzheimer's and dementia patients in nursing homes because of like the ability to still be fashionable, but still the functionality related to it. And then I have a student that wants to work on swimwear, but for large-breasted women because she had a breast reduction and the challenges that she faced. So it's never the same. Like, I don't know about you, but when I used to teach traditional apparel design and product development, it was a lot of the same. It was, you know, a lot of rich, white, young girls in couture-level design. Like, I'm like, okay, I don't want to see that anymore. I don't want to have seven groups showing me, you know, $3,000, you know, shirts, because that's not realistic as to what our industry is about. Doing this has, in a way, forced my students to think beyond the natural traditional approach. And they come up with it on their own. One student yesterday wants to work with little people who have dwarfism. And so they all came up with these on their own. I know. I cannot take credit for all of it because it has to be their creativity and their mind that generates it. But I will take credit for putting that seed in every single class that I've taught that got them to this level where they can say, oh, I can think bigger than the traditional way.
And yeah, I think that's really key that you have that seed in each class. I used to teach a 300 level design product development class. We did computerized pattern making in there. And I made them do a group project and I would prescribe basically the target market. And, you know, and I would, you know, try to have some diversity within that and, you know, nowhere near what you have. But I remember one group had 40-year-old pregnant women and they thought that I was a demon.
Kidding. For just assigning that to them. How dare you?
One student stood up in the computer lab and yelled at me and asked me, and I wasn't even 40 at that time, why are you doing this? Is it because you want to have a child at 40? But like,
no.
I'm not even 40 yet. I know I'm over 25, so you think that I'm like 80 years old now. And I was like, wow, you just really stood up and yelled at me.
Yeah, that's the same reaction I got when I first started doing it. They were like, you know, how dare you make us not look at, you know, young, rich, you know, consumers. I'm like, because there's a whole lot more out there than young, rich consumers, man.
Not many young, rich consumers. So if you want to eat,
They think they're going to make $400,000 a year.
But you know, I think the key for you too is, like you said, that you threaded it, you know, thread. Yeah. I can't even say it. You put the needle in the thread all the way.
Love it. I think love it.
We're early on, you know, in their academic program. And so, you know, that was key. You know, I was throwing it at them, you know, in a one project at the 300 level. And, it, you know, some of them threw it right back at me.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And you know, in the beginning, it's not what they're used to as design and product development students. They're not used to thinking out of the traditional, you know, even just women's wear. Like, to even get them to think about men's wear, children's wear is stretching it sometimes. So, I mean, I can understand that, but, and not everybody, you know, not all the students are sold on it, but the majority of them realize benefit of what they get out of doing it, because they're forced to think about a consumer in a way that they just never had to. Because if you're thinking about a young person, you just reflect inward. You don't have to think outward.
Well, I always found the projects were much better when they had to think about target market that they weren't a member of. Yeah. And this, I just had Lindsay Vincent Culper, who works in the fishing apparel industry, on the pod.
Awesome. Cool.
And this kind of, and she's done a whole, all types of outdoor. So this kind of goes against what, you know, I was on my soapbox about in that podcast, that you need to be a member of the group. But I think for really technical outdoor, you know, I cannot design ski wear. And she said that, you know, she didn't fish before she took that one job that's now led to, you know, multiple years in this career. But she said the first thing that she did after she moved from Colorado to Montana was she learned how to fish. And, you know, that really, you know, helped inform. And so, but, you know, for some ready to wear, you don't need to be in that target market.
No, you don't. And unfortunately, the reason why some of the disconnect happens with apparel and the consumer is because the brands don't take the time to understand the consumer. I mean, it's an investment of time, which equals money, right? So it all comes down to the good old dollar. And I understand that. But then you get all of the revenue income challenges that these brands are facing because they're not hitting the mark. And like I tell my students, if you want to know what a 40-year-old pregnant woman wants, I don't know. How about you go ask a 40-year-old pregnant woman what she wants? Like, it's not that complicated. A solution, for Christ's sake. Like, we don't have to imagine, because there are 40-year-old pregnant women out there.
Absolutely. Well, that was part of the project. They had to go interview people. And then I was really getting like,
you are horrible.
But I like that you know, the empathy part too, you know, that you're framing your courses and your teaching around empathy. And could you do that for the rest of the world too? Just to them.
Oh, God, wish I could, Yolanda. Maybe if there's enough of us and we hook arms and we walk across the globe, maybe, I don't know, but God help me. I'm trying in my own little section of the world.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for all that you're doing.
Well, you're not a human being too. I got a 21-year-old that's getting ready to graduate, and I have made sure he's an empathetic soul.
Well, you could just—I mean, when I saw your family, you could just tell that, you know, you've got it together. You got it together. It'll be fun to see what he does.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, so technology plays a huge part in really being able to meet the needs of humans apparel wise. And, you know, there's the apparel industry sometimes is slow to adopt some things, but the pandemic kind of helped move things along a little faster. You know, one of the good outcomes from it, especially with 3D pattern making and modeling of apparel. And I know that you're an expert with CLO. So first let our audience kind of know what CLO is, and then, you know, talk about your work with.
Sure. So I will say this at the beginning as a disclaimer. As a 53-year-old woman, if I can learn CLO, anybody can learn CLO. because I was very intimidated in the technology gap, right? Like I was in the industry when we hand sketched and, you know, used a copy machine to replicate things. We didn't have, you know, they were still using DOS prompt computers, for God's sakes. So, you know, first thing I would say is don't be intimidated by it, because if I can do it, anybody can do it. The Claw 3D is a virtual 3D software program that allows you to, you can manipulate patterns. So you can do basic pattern making in Claw, but you can also design through Claw. Like you can draft and you can, the evolution of the technology has been mind-boggling how quickly they have continue to innovate. And I mean, they literally innovate like every couple of weeks. There's a new update that introduces a new tool that will do something interesting. So if I'd have had that when I was a designer in the industry, oh, holy camoli, it would have been a game changer in terms of my confidence in myself as a designer, but also in the ability to produce ideas for ideation and you know, brand development in a way that was just not present. So when I came into the department and started teaching full-time tenure track, we were using Optitex, which Optitex is also a 3D program, but it was originally created for the automotive industry. And then people found out, oh, it could be helpful in apparel, but it was not user-friendly at all. It was like beating your head against the wall, trying to even figure out what to, you know, how to make it do what it was supposed to do. And so I kept trying to get my department chair to invest in Claw. And they, you know, as a good department chair should do, like monetarily, financially, like we've already invested in this. Why would we invest in something else? And I kept at it and kept at it and showed the pros and cons and the price difference and just the level of intimidation our students had with it. None of them were becoming proficient in Optitex because they were too afraid of it. It was too wonky. So I said, they can, the first day, if I will tell you, the first day I teach a class with Claw, they will be able to create something by the end of that class. They will be able to create something that looks like a garment on an avatar. I guarantee it. And there's no way you could have done that with Optitex, not with my lack of knowledge of it. So, it was horrible. So I finally convinced our department chair to invest in it. And then me being me, I got to know the person at Claw that helps with the colleges and, you know, asked all kinds of questions, because I have no problem asking questions. If I don't know something, I have no problem admitting that I don't know something. And so I was like really wanting more training. And so he did a one-on-one training with me and a couple of other colleagues, and we kind of got the scope of it. But I'd never had enough time to really work in it consistently to become as proficient as I wanted. So I asked my department chair, I'm like, can I do like a job shadow over the summer in the department help pay where I go and like sit next to my friend at Claw and learn from him? And she was like, well, sure. Like, yeah, we can organize something like that. Talk to him and see what it would cost. So I called him and talked to him about it. He was like, you know, why don't we do something for all the educators? Like, if you want it, there's got to be other educators. I'm like, score. Like, yes, let's do that. So they worked on a program and developed a Claw certification for educators. And in 2023, they hosted it in New York. It was a week, Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, every day, working in Claw. And then before we got there, we had to do like a certification project to show that we had basic fundamental skills in Claw. And then that's what got us into the program. And then, you know, we were able to be trained and get additional training while we were there. And so since then, I have just grown in confidence with the program, because you realize it's like any other software program. I mean, it's going to change. So what you knew yesterday is going to be different tomorrow. And it's okay if you don't know where that tool is today, because it was someplace else tomorrow. We'll figure it out. And they push out such great interactive training tools to kind of keep you up to date with the updates and how you can use. And then right now I'm going through a reaccreditation. They've sent us, those of us that were in that first group, sent us a project, and we've had about 2.5 weeks to complete the project. And then once we submit it at the end of the month, then they review it to make sure it's all based on the new updates that are in the Claw system, so that we can demonstrate that we can show our students how to use the new updated tools through a completed kind of asset of a product. And then we'll get, you know, a letter saying that we've been recertified. And It really has been amazing because just the process of me going through the training has allowed me to be more understanding with my students. And so they're still very intimidated by CLO because it's something new. And I'm like, you know, you're gonna make mistakes and that's gonna be okay. And we're gonna figure it out and we're not gonna deduct points for that. And you're not gonna, you know, get an S because you made a mistake. And the growth I saw so we integrated it into every PD class that we have, you know, as it's applicable to that, you know, course curriculum. You know, maybe it's very basic here, more advanced here. So I taught tech design last semester, and the group of students that were in that class were the first group of students that have had it like through a variety of courses. And still, when they came in, they were very intimidated. They were like, there's no way we're going to be able to accomplish what you're asking us to accomplish. And I said, yes, you will. I'm going to teach you. So I'm not asking you to do anything that I will teach you how to do. And you have the capacity. What they came out with at the end of the semester far surpassed what I expected. And it was just, they started falling in love with it and started playing with it outside of class and realized that they were going to make mistakes and challenging themselves. And I'm like, that to me is a work. Whether it's perfect, like whether every stitch is perfect or every seam structure is perfect, the fact that they fell in love with it and felt good about it, that to me is a work, a plus worthy out of it. So it is just a phenomenal tool. And CLO's telling us that they get brands that call them and say, who's teaching CLO and who's teaching it well? So CLO can say, well, we've got this suite of professors, educators out there that are accredited. We have trained them. We know that they're proficient in this. And so the students that they are teaching are going to be, you know, a highly marketable compared to students that, you know, may not be getting it at all in their curriculum.
Oh, you've just, you know, laid out so many really essential best practices as a faculty member, as a researcher, as a liaison between industry and academia. To our audience members that are faculty members in apparel or fashion programs or graduate students that are hoping, one key thing that Dr. McKee Black said is really that industry connection with the people that are creating the software, because that was something that early on in my career, having those relationships, I was able to call people up, get information, get trainings, you know, send students their way, but going to the actual people that are producing, distributing, manufacturing, creating that software and getting a connection with them as a faculty member is so key,
Well, and they're usually pretty much focused on industry because that's where the money is, right? Like they can get price for all their stuff. We as educators want a discount on everything that we ask them for. So, but they don't, I don't think they always realize the far reach that they can have if they are investing in the students, because then that student is going to go to a job and maybe that job's using OptiText or Browseware. And they say, you know what, you really need to do CLO because this is what it's going to do. So I think that CLO's done a really good job at that. I don't have any experience with any of the other softwares like Browsewares and VStitchers and all the others, but CLO really tries to listen to educators. And the person that's in charge of that, Jim Simon, that's at CLO, if I'm going to have to share this with him since I got a shout out to him. He was an apparel and design educator himself. So he knows what he needs to do to help us be better educators. So in that aspect, again, I'm biased because it's the only exposure I have, but CLO's doing a really, really good job of making that connection with educators.
Well, industry platforms that, you know, do make that connection and help educators, you know, educate and train students. And, you know, it's not just, you know, that there's that technical training, but understanding the philosophy behind the platform. You know, you're creating ambassadors, you know, that are, like you said, going out to the industry that then can advocate for, oh, we need this platform or we need this, you know, software to be able to, you know, move the company forward. So,
right. That's
right. Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. I, So I want to ask your thoughts on artificial intelligence. What are your thoughts on it and its impact, you know, technology-wise
Right? Like, I said, it might be controversial because I know in our discipline, there's a lot of back and forth about, is it good to have it as an educator, right? My philosophy is it's not going anywhere. It's only going to get more prolific. So it's no different than when we started having these phones, you know, with a calculator built in and miniature computers right at our hand. And how are we going to keep our students from using their phone? You're not. So how about we figure out how to integrate, you know, find a way to teach that they don't want to look at their phone, maybe. But the AI, that stuff is like in a nanosecond, it evolves. Like we were joking earlier about ChatGPT, but when I've been in ChatGPT and maybe taken a break for a week and go back in, the amount of knowledge that it has learned through other avenues that it dredges from is mind-boggling, right? Like it's only as good as what we teach it. So we have to prepare our students to know how to engage with it ethically and how to use their knowledge to feed it. Because if they give it a prompt like, I want some pretty fabric, you know, a pretty floral fabric that will work on a blouse. Well, I mean, that's as broad as you can get. How about you narrow it down to a fiber and a fabrication and maybe a percentage of the fiber content and finishes that go with it? So what we're teaching our students, we can see instantaneously the knowledge that we have, you know, made available to them and their ability to create a prompt or an asset through that AI in a way that is a pretty good rendition first go. So I'm not afraid of it. I was in the beginning because I didn't know enough about it. Once I started learning about it, and I have a PhD student that I'm advising, and she happens to be just a really good friend of mine as well. We've become real close. She and I were talking about it one day over a meeting about her dissertation. And she's like, Carrie, it's no different than if you're a really good graduate assistant. She said, you have to teach that graduate assistant how to do a lit review. You're teaching the ChatGPT how to do the lit review the way you want the lit review to be done. She said, it's really no different than that. She said, so you have to think about it from that perspective. It isn't you just not doing the work. You still have to do the work with the ChatGPT. I still have to know what the heck I'm talking about to engage with the ChatGPT or the AI in an Adobe Illustrator or whatever the AI is. And I have to be able to have enough knowledge to assess the outcome to know if it's valid. And that's the other piece.
Absolutely. I agree with you. We have to teach our students to be, regardless of what year, time, space, wherever, you know, they are, if they're on the moon, Mars,
that's right,
you know, 50 years from now, you know, they need to be critical consumers of knowledge. I mean, that is something that we have to help them. And, you know, yeah, ChatGPT or any of the AI platforms might come back with something that's like, not this, you know, this not right. But, you know, Innovation Insights, there is no way, because, you know, this is my side gig. And, you know, it's vacation days like today when I'm recording or before 8 o'clock or after 5 o'clock or weekend. There's no way we could build this business without AI helping me. And I have trained and trained and trained. And like I said, now it knows me. It's like, oh, Yolanda, that's a great idea. Okay, that's working. It's all about why. I'm like, no, I'm not. And this is creepy that you're thinking my ideas are great.
Yeah, you have to talk to it like it's a human to get what you want, which is weird. Like, that took a long time. I'm like, oh, thank you so much for your insight. You know, could you do this for me? And it's like, and, you know, and I've had experiences where it was like, you know, if my tone was off, like it would say, like it would respond back to me, like, you know, are you having an off day kind of thing? And I'm like, that's weird. But, you know, it's there and it's not going anywhere. And it helps us do things that would have been time sucking before. Like, and like you said, as a side gig, you don't have the time to do all that. I don't I could be spending much more time that's going to produce something much more beneficial than writing, you know, a letter of recommendation that I could ask ChatGPT to give me a skeleton of, and I can plug in my keywords, right? It doesn't mean that I let ChatGPT tell me about somebody that they don't know.
Exactly.
Not it. I mean, I have yet to take something from ChatGPT the very first time and copy and paste it. I don't do that, but I use it as, it's wonderful as an ideation tool.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Amazing as an ideation tool, because when I was prepping for class this semester, I was like, this is what I want to do in this class. This is the content I'm teaching. Suggest some fun, engaging, interactive activities that would align with this topic. And it was like things that I had never even thought of. And I was like, oh, this has saved me angst, like just hours of angst, feeling like I'm a horrible instructor that can't come up with ideas.
Absolutely. It does. It does. It's sometimes it's overwhelming because how many ideas it comes up. It's like, oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. And then it's like, okay, do you want to, you know, dig deeper into these ideas? And I'm like,
oh, I don't know.
You know, the 20 ideas you gave me, I'm not ready to.
Yeah, I told it, can you make that less intense? Can we rein that one back a bit?
Yeah. Well, I want to get your thoughts on how do you define innovation? We ask all of our guests this.
I love that question. I think how I would define innovation is thinking creatively about your perspective on the world, right? Because if you're innovative in your thought, if you're innovative in your relationship with people, then that innovative thought is going to seep into every aspect of your life, right? We often hear a word like innovation and we think it has to be, oh, I have to be developing like something that takes me to the moon or, you know, something that's going to completely change the paradigm of our world, right? Like, you know, when computers were created. But innovation is learning how to use ChatGPT in a way that is effective for your particular area of industry or discipline. Innovation is listening to your colleagues and gaining knowledge that adds to your knowledge toolbox and then taking it to another level. That's how I see innovation.
I love that definition. And it so aligns with, we just started some rebranding in 2025 where our name, Innovation Insights, the I at the beginning of innovation is lowercase. And then everything else is capital because we are embracing the small innovations. And, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, solving some major global issue. You know, it can be small things. So you really provide some nice examples of that. So thank you.
I love it. I love it.
Okay. Well, we're going to have you back because, I mean, there's so many things to talk about.
Yeah. I am game anytime, anywhere, sister.
Okay, that sounds good. And yeah, I will be bothering you about all types of things. You can be like, Yolanda.
Yeah.
No.
Unless you email.
I would never say that. Would never do that. Never, never, never. I have watched you from afar for years before you met me. So there is never a time that you could say no. That you could ask me and say, I would say no. Absolutely not.
Yeah, I think I should probably apologize for what you saw from far away.
No, it was every single bit of it was wonderful. In professional, above par. It's true. It's absolutely true.
Well, I'm so, you know, proud of the work and inspired by the work that you're doing. And, you know, let me know how I can personally support you or Innovation Insights can support you as you continue to work, and we'll have you back. I'll be bothering you over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So
panels, studies. Yeah. Let's do it. I'll help.
That'll be good.
Oh. We're gonna change the world on podcasts.
Absolutely. Oh, well, to our listeners, I hope that you found this conversation as enlightening and as impactful as I have. To learn more about Dr. McBee Black's work, please visit her profile at the University of Missouri Textiles and Apparel Management Department website. We'll make sure that items are linked in the podcast episode and the clips that we produce from this. And just thank you for being here for another episode of Innovation Insights Podcast. And be sure to subscribe, leave comments, review. If you have ideas for other people that you'd like for us to have on the podcast, let us know. And until the next time, keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.